Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 57, section 6, which is old single column, page 657. Okay, so recall from last time that they gave us an extended discussion of the initiation of the solar system. We had this, our star, our sun, sitting there as a solitary orb, but a variable star, pulsating, you know, radially in and out. And along came this dark island of space, passing through this region of the local universe, and passed close enough that a massive tongue of gas was pulled off the sun, and that supplied the material for all that gas to begin to contract and eventually condense into 12 planets. Jupiter and Saturn and the big bulge of the tongue of gas and in the middle of it, and 5 planets on each side. 5 littler, smaller planets on each side. Obviously, Uranus and Neptune are fairly decent-sized, gas planets as well out there. But we're ready now to move forward, primarily with the formation and evolution of the Earth. We still have a little bit of passing commentary on the rest of the solar system. But, they're sort of just continuing to zero in more and more and more. Remember, one of the things that we still have left hanging, section 5, was called The Origin of Monmasha. Remember, I mentioned that the official, quote-unquote, naming has yet to occur. So we have that point of evolution to pass through with the solar system and see exactly what that point in the evolutionary process represents that's worthy of an official designation like that. Remember, it's a complex, there's lots and lots of material besides, it wasn't just one clean tongue of matter pulled off, the point at which the Angana system began to impact the sun until its closest approach was 500,000 years. And so there was lots and lots of material that was liberated, at least temporarily, from the immediate grasp of the sun, and is, littering the whole area. It was all nice and cleaned up, and now it's a big mess. That's where we're entering in, including, remember, there were three relatively large objects that the sun captured from the outskirts of the Angana system, and that interjected retrograde motion into the solar system. And we talked about how, you clearly have 3 big divot points of retrograde in the solar system from those 3 objects. But it's the mess that we're really where we pick up the story here again. Now the things have gotten all messed up. Things need to start to go through a long process to settle back down into some equilibrium again.
And Chris, the time that it took for Momasha, let's say, to do this was probably, what, about a billion and a half years? Was it that
to do what?
to come through and just, you know, pull off the planets. You know,
for the Angana system?
Yeah,
that's coming up here in the first paragraph. We'll mention that.
Okay.
All right. So let's just, well, I was going to bring that up here just as soon as we read. So let's get started here.
Section 6, the solar system stage, the planet forming era. Subsequent to the birth of the solar system, a period of diminishing solar disgorgement ensued. Decreasingly, for another 500,000 years, the sun continued to pour forth diminishing volumes of matter into surrounding space. But during these early times of erratic orbits, when the surrounding bodies made their nearest approach to the sun, the solar parent was able to recapture a large portion of this meteoric material.
Okay, so two things. First, John, as John was wondering there, so you have 500,000 years from beginning to have the Angana system, beginning to have an impact on the sun, like I said, until closest approach. Obviously, you've got a parallel or reciprocal, maybe you might say, fact on the other side, from closest approach to finally getting, you know, so far away that it's no longer really significantly impacting gravitationally. So you have 1,000,000 years. You know, this impact, you know, even though you're not literally slamming two things together, it's still called an impact. It's 1,000,000 years long, this impact of the Angana system on the sun. And as I was saying, you can see them mentioning it there, erratic orbits. Okay, you know, you've got just stuff, you know, all over the place, and stuff is contracting some, you know, so you start to have localized regions of a little bit greater gravity, and everything is pulling on everything else in every which direction, and it's all going around the sun in all kinds of different orbits. It's a very, you know, a chaotic situation. So everything is getting perturbed. Nothing is very stable. You know, very easily things end up falling back into the sun rather than staying in some, you know, bounded away from the sun orbit. And that will go on for a long time before things finally start to settle down and there's some stability of ongoing orbits. But even then, the planets are all, you know, the bigger they get, the more they interact. And, you know, there's a whole tug of war that goes on that finally settles into the way things have stabilized as we know them today. Yep.
Well, I'm assuming the sun was on a path. It wasn't just sitting stationary in space.
Of course not. Yeah.
So these two bodies must have altered the path to some degree. So that relative to other stars that it might be kind of more or less parallel to, now it's suddenly going off in a different direction.
Right, exactly. Like we talked about, I mean, it's obviously not just the Angana system is not just passing by our star. Passing by a whole bunch of stars, you know, I mean, just in the local region of of our local universe that are from the Andromeda Nebula, who knows what else it did as it continued on, you know, where, you know, it's somewhere right now doing things, right? Somewhere in the Milky Way galaxy. Someday, you know, billions and billions of years from now, trillions of years from now, someone else will have a book in their lap, you know, telling about, you know, what the Angana system did, you know, to their solar system. But we've got this, you know, this very, very jumbled up situation that needs to be brought back into some semblance of stability and order again. And the main player in that whole process is not some finger of God that comes in with a broom and sweeps everything up into nice little neat piles. It all does it pretty much within itself, right? And gravity is the main actor. And just straightforward gravitational interaction, you know, like you think of Newtonian gravity between two objects, plus the next order effect, the tidal issue. You have that tidal differential across every object. That's about what they're going to bring up next. And that tidal grip, the fact that the gravity from a point varies as 1/r² as you move away from that point, so that it definitely diminishes, as you go across a distance, like across the diameter of an object. An object is not being gripped in a nice uniform fashion. It's being torqued on, being pulled more on one side than the other, and so you have this this tidal torquing, this wrenching of objects, and it all is a very complex dance where things get into resonances, various whole number ratios of distances and whatnot. Everything, there's this whole complex dance that stuff goes through, and temporarily is kind of satisfied, but then eventually moves out of that resonance, and what you'll see they're about to mention, some of the most straightforward issues like that. But you definitely see this when you go to the outer part of the solar system. Well, there's still lots and lots of objects out there, and they get bunched up at specific distances from the sun that are resonances, relative to the gravity of the other objects. So it's a very, very kind of fascinating mathematical dance that all this stuff goes through. They want to definitely, just sort of remind you of that by speaking a little bit about about some issues of tidal influence that anyone can relate to a bit without having to be a sophisticated, have sophisticated astronomical knowledge or anything. Okay, but for a scientist, this is just reminding you of kind of what I'm saying. There's this whole complex dance that we can, we can basically model. We can take lots and lots of objects and have them interacting gravitationally, and see how as the solar system would have been forming, orbits would be, moving in and out and stuff as, things get sped up and slowed down, and so the planets don't just get on one distance from the sun and have, right at the beginning and have stayed that way the whole time. They finally have settled into the distances they are now. Okay. After all the interaction has, found some equilibrium. Okay, so let's read a little bit here.
The planets nearest the sun were the first to have their revolution slowed down by tidal friction. Such gravitational influences also contribute to the stabilization of planetary orbits while acting as a brake on the rate of planetary axial revolution, causing a planet to revolve ever slower until axial revolution ceases, leaving one hemisphere of the planet always turned toward the sun or larger body, as is illustrated by the planet Mercury and by the moon, which has always turns the same face toward Urantia.
Okay, so this issue of tidal locking, not only do you have all this tidal interaction, but things can eventually get locked in. And one of the resonances that you can have is a spin orbit resonance, you can call it. The rotation of the object on its axis in relationship to its revolution around the central object, whether it's a moon around a planet or a planet around the sun. Think about it. If you just put your two fists side by side, if one's the moon and one's the earth, think of rotating one of them as the earth rotating on its axis. And you just, picture that the moon, is pulling on that. You're wanting to, is resisting it, wanting, the earth rotating on its axis like that. It's pulling more on the close side than it is on the far side. And so there's a friction, quote unquote, right, that is, you know, dragging on the rotation of the Earth, or, you know, or any object, you know, going around another. Okay, and like I said, things can get locked into these resonances. Like the moon around the Earth is locked into a 1-1, you know, resonance. It rotates once on its axis for going around the Earth one time. You know, so it's a 1-to-1 spin orbit resonance.
Precisely.
Yeah.
So it is rotating. It's just rotating at that rate.
Right. It's rotating exactly the same rate as it goes around the Earth. I mean, if it wasn't rotating, you know, just picture that, right? I mean, you'd see the whole thing as it went around one time, right? It's got to be rotating, you know, as it goes around, in order to keep the same face towards it. And you know, that, and initially it wasn't doing that, you know, and eventually it got into that mode. And the distance away from the Earth varied, you know, as that was happening. And everything has, you know, the laws of gravity and of motion are all in play. And, you know, if it's going at a certain speed, it's at a certain distance away from the central object that it's revolving around. Okay, so the distance between the Earth and the Moon varies with all of this. You know, they'll bring that up here in a little bit.
So the speed that is varying as well.
Right. All this is, you know, all these things are, you know, in flux. Okay. The distance and the speeds and rotations and all this sort of stuff, it's all interacting.
What would move it back and forth?
Well, again, I mean, you know, think about, you know, for Mercury to go around the Sun, it's got to go around a lot faster than Pluto going around the Sun. I mean, you know, if you make the planet go slower, it's got to be farther out.
Right. Mm-hmm. But I'm talking about the variation. Why doesn't it just lock into one distance? Why does it vary sometimes closer, sometimes farther?
Well, again, there's an equilibrium, you know, between the gravitational pull and the speed.
Oh, so it gets too close, it causes it to speed up.
Right.
It forces it away, and then it, okay.
Right. You can, you know, if you're in a rocket ship going around the Earth, you know, you can vary your by speeding up or slowing down the rocket.
I see.
Change your orbit. You know, so, you know, when we're sending satellites throughout the solar system, we're doing all that sort of stuff. You know, we're changing the velocities and changing the orbit. You know, it's orbiting the Sun, say, this thing, and we're setting out to Jupiter, say. You know, it's in orbit about the Sun, you know, and we're changing its orbit about the Sun. So it's all a very complex system, right? And the thing with Mercury, okay, so it's been getting more, you know, getting closer and closer to being brought into the same 1-to-1 spin orbit resonance that the Moon around the Earth is. Hasn't quite gotten there, and right now it's in a neat little resonance. It's in a 3-2 resonance. It rotates on its axis 3 times for every 2 times it goes around the Sun.
Mercury,
right? So it's in a 3-2 resonance. You know, so in other words, when it goes around the Sun one time, it rotates on its axis 1.5 times. Yeah, exactly. It's in a 3-2 spin orbit resonance. It's locked in. You know, so you have these resonances. I mean, eventually it will, you know, be tweaked off of that resonance. But, yeah, I mean, the Moon would have been in a 3-2 resonance at some point in the distant past as well. Going from 1.5-to-1 down to 1-to-1, like it is now.
Is 1-to-1 the most stable?
Yeah. Well, as you're going to see, it doesn't just stay there. Okay, but you know, and obviously, it gets down to that ratio, and then things, you know, start to change. But it starts up. You know, you've got this gas that's contracting, and it's spinning faster and faster and faster. So the object starts out rotating very, very fast. You know, relative to its orbit about the central object, and that's what they're talking about. But its tidal friction slows it down and slows it down and slows it down and slows it down, you know, over time. Yeah. So, you know, these planets aren't whirling at insane, you know, speeds, you know. You know, think about how fast a skater starts bending by just pulling in their arms, right? I mean, you know, so you bring all that stuff in from a very, you know, separated state to a very condensed state, and it's rotating really fast.
What would give it the initial impetus to spin?
Well, I mean, you've got everything, you know, remember, was initially going around because it's part of the sun.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, the sun is rotating, and you know, but you know, in terms of, you know, all you have is just a slight, any sort of slight perturbation of a perfectly symmetric thing. You know, a little bit of an asymmetry, and it's going to, as a gas, you know, contracts, it's going to amplify that conservation of angular momentum, and it'll just spin faster and faster.
It's like a skater.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we could use that as sort of a gauge to. How long has that planet been condensed, you know, based on its axial rotation, stuff like that.
Yep. So that's obviously kind of a clock, as you could tell there. You know, and people have stumbled over this, you know, the latter part of this paragraph, thinking that whoever wrote this, you know, thinks that Mercury is locked in a 1-1, which is what they thought, you know, way back when. In the 20th century, but you can see they're very careful to not. I mean, the 1-to-1 is just, you know, for the moon. You know, it's not for both of them. You know, but that 3-2 resonance that it's locked in is an illustration, like they say there, of what they're talking about, right? You know? Yeah. So it isn't. You know, there are times in the book when you. If you don't focus in very precisely, you'll definitely trip over yourself. Just note how carefully they word things, and you won't have issues like that. Now they're going to give us a little bit more, and you might kind of wonder what's up with this next conversation they're giving. They're basically they want to just. Give you a little bit more of a sense of the early evolution of things, physical evolution, can be in states that if you're coming at it from a religious, historical religious perspective, will strike you as not the hand of God. It will seem like the hand of chaos. And it's important to remember that... Yeah, you know, just as it's hard for us to think about how somehow evolution is creativity in time when we watch this solar system forming and it seems all very chaotic and not the order that we imagine from God, the celestials, you know, the authors have the same thing as they look out in the outer space levels, right? And they're going, I don't see the hand of God anywhere. It just seems like chaos. You know, beautiful spirals are slamming into each other and being all messed up. And, you know, this is the same thing on a small scale. And, you know, they just need to remind themselves the way we need to remind ourselves that you've got to step back and look at a very big picture over a very long span of time in order to see the hand of order. When you're dealing with evolutionary processes, it's there. It's just it's not the the finger snap of fiat, it's not the magic man snapping his fingers. Right? It's an evolutionary process. So let's get a little bit more here.
When the tidal frictions of the moon and Earth and the Earth become equalized. The Earth will always turn the same hemisphere toward the moon, and the day and month will be analogous, in length about 47 days. When such stability of orbits is attained, tidal frictions will go into reverse action, no longer driving the moon farther away from the Earth, but gradually drawing the satellite toward the planet. And then, in that far distant future, when the moon approaches to within about 11,000 miles of the Earth, the gravity action of the latter will cause the moon to disrupt, and this tidal gravity explosion will shatter the moon into small particles, which may assemble about the world as rings of matter, resembling those of Saturn, or may be gradually drawn into the Earth as meteors.
Okay. So now, on the one hand, it gives you a general description of what happens. Okay, but when they use the specific example of the Earth and the Moon, it gets a little scary. Okay. So what's between the lines, of sort of like sort of forcing the thought upon you? Now, if you have no sense of the rest of the book, like if you, for instance, you hadn't just read about, our planet deep and, the stages of light and life and all that sort of stuff, billions and billions and trillions of years in the future and all of the perfect order of everything that it's talked about there. If you're just reading from the beginning of part three here, you go, okay, I guess one day, the moon will be ripped apart and it'll turn into a ring or something, or rain down meteors and kill everyone or whatever. And I go, but, if you have read the rest, it's like, okay, that's not going to happen. All right, so that's a little reminder, that at some point in the future, the master physical controllers must take very definitive control of this situation. You can't have, the moon coming in and being ripped apart like this and raining meteors down on, on the world's in the seventh stage of light and life or whatever, right? Okay.
Especially with Michael's.
So, it's Michael's world and all that sort of stuff. It's not going to be destroyed by tidal friction. Okay?
11,000 miles away, that would be a crazy, scary moon. Before you go into
And that's, of course, that's 11,000 from the center of the Earth, not from the surface of the Earth. But
Can you explain this a little bit more? In other words, what it's saying, is it saying that right now the moon is basically moving away? I mean, can you...
So let's... I was going to get to that. So let's just think about the scenario, what's happening right now. The moon is locked so that it's one face of it always is towards the Earth. One half of it is always toward the Earth. But if you're on the moon, you can see all the sides of the Earth. But eventually, it'll get totally tidally locked. And they literally go around together. One hemisphere of the Earth is always facing one hemisphere of the moon, and vice versa. But now, how does it get to that stage? Well, like we were picturing before, right now, the Earth is rotating a lot faster than the moon is going around, right? A day is shorter than a month, right? So relative to a day, the moon is kind of just sitting there, and the Earth is rotating. And so, this object, this moon, is pulling on the Earth. It doesn't want it to rotate like that. There's a tidal drag on the rotation of the Earth. The Earth is slowing down because the moon is pulling back on it. Okay? And so slowly Earth is rotating at a slower and slower rate.
Is that why they have to adjust the clock?
That's one of the reasons why you need a leap second. Okay, but not the others. I mean, that slowing down is there with a lot of other things. I mean, any sort of shifts in the distribution of mass within the Earth, will change its rotation rate and stuff, at the same sort of magnitude. But yes, that is one of the reasons why occasionally you need a leap second is, over time, that the moon slowing down the Earth's rotation would add up to a whole second, ignoring all the other stuff that would alter the rotation rate. Okay, but as the Earth slows down over these long spans of time, the moon is moving out to a higher and higher orbit. You know, as you see here, until eventually it gets to, it takes 47 days to go around the Earth. Okay? Yeah, or a month and a half, right? Then, and the Earth, a day will be that long too. Okay. And then.
The Earth will be that slow too.
Right, the Earth will be going, yeah, it'll take 47 days to rotate once on its axis. A day would be 47 days long. Okay.
Would a day be longer too on the Earth?
Right, that's what he just said. The Earth rotates on its axis.
Instead of being one day?
Instead of one day, it'd be 47 days.
Wow.
Okay.
So it'd be 47 times longer.
Yeah.
You have to go to work.
Right. Now.
I think how hot it would get.
Now,
what we have now,
right? Now you know that, these. You know, the length of days and stuff like that isn't just arbitrary. You know, when we talk about the architectural spheres, you know, these things aren't just whatever, right, in terms of how fast they rotate on their axis and stuff like this. You know, reasons that we don't understand, there has to be some eventual length of the day that they want. I mean, maybe it's pretty close to what it is right now. But if you just, you know, if you forget about that the universe is mind-made and personality-managed, and you just imagine it to have magically come into existence and just be a bunch of matter doing its thing, all right, this is the way the story would play out. All right, the Earth would slow down and slow down and slow down until finally, you know, they're both tightly locked. The Earth and the Moon are tightly locked together at this 47-day period, and then it'll, you know, start reversing and it'll start bringing the Moon back in until finally it gets so close that the Earth tightly rips the Moon apart, okay, and spreads its particles into a ring, or you know, they come crashing down on the planet.
So, when I read this first time, my thought was, well, you know, if people worry about big, huge meteors crashing into the Earth and destroying it. Well, if they would do this to the Moon, why wouldn't it do it to a meteor? In other words, why wouldn't it tidally erupt as well?
Yeah, okay, so we'll get a little bit more details here in the I think it's in the next paragraph, isn't it? Or in a couple paragraphs. Oh, no, it is the next paragraph. Yeah, the next paragraph. Think about it. You've got a lot of complexity here. You know, initially when you sort of think about this problem of tidally pulling an orbiting object apart, you know, you're sort of just thinking of it as a collection of particles that are just held together by gravity. You know, and so all you have to do is just overcome the self-gravitation of that collection of particles to distribute them, you know, hinder and yon. But obviously, there's more than just gravity holding stuff together. There's, you know, other forces bonding things together. I mean, this table is not being held together by gravity, right? To rip that table apart, I don't just have to overcome the gravity, which is trivial, you know, between the, you know, the atoms in that table. I've got to rip the bonds apart, the molecular bonds, okay? So, you know, if I have a little rock flying, you know, diving into the Earth, you know, it stays together as a rock.
Even a big rock.
You know, even a fairly big rock, it stays together. It doesn't get ripped apart into little pieces, you know, and then come raining in. I mean, it just comes in as one big rock, right? I mean, the International Space Station is not ripped apart by, you know, tidal differential, for instance. It just goes around and around the Earth, right? because it isn't just being held together by gravity. Okay. You know, an astronaut that goes out on a spacewalk, he's not, you know, turned into a cloud of dust by being ripped apart by tidal differential across his body. I mean, he's, you know, there's internal forces holding your body together, right? They're a lot stronger. Okay, so you've got this, you know, complex issue of how much internal integrity the object has relative to this tidal tearing, you know, and they've given you the little calculation, and it's a it has a lot to do with the with the bigger issues, how dense the Earth is, how dense the Moon is, and all these sorts of things. But you can you can make rough calculations of this. But they're giving you that, considering all these differences of densities and internal integrity and all this, that about 11,000 miles from the center of the Earth, the Moon would get ripped apart. Okay, it would overcome its internal integrity and get ripped apart,
which is 7,000 miles from the surface.
Right. So yeah. Right. And, yeah. It's yeah.
Which basically means you're blacked out from the sun.
Yeah. All right. It's getting in close. It's definitely getting in close. I mean, think of the tides on the Earth from the Moon being that close. Okay. That would be a huge issue. Right. Yeah. You're worried about a little bit of ice melting and the oceans going up? Okay, that that would not be an issue if the Moon was that close.
But you've got them locked in, so the oceans are kind of all on one side of the Earth.
Right. This is right.
Yeah, they wouldn't fluctuate.
Right, the more you think about this, right, see, the more, you know. Well, but remember, you know, as it's starting to come back in, it's not locked like that anymore. Things have, you know, gotten mixed up again. It's not staying locked together like this. You know, it's in that state when it's 47, but as it comes in, it's going around faster and faster and faster again, you know, as it comes back in.
Okay. But planets without life, so to speak, this could be a...
Right, if you've got you know, planets, you know that are not inhabited, you know, or even if, you know, it doesn't have to be a totally uninhabited solar system, but just some planet in the solar system that's not inhabited, you know, it can go through this whole process. All four of the big gas giants have rings around them, because moons have gotten ripped up and turned into ring systems around them, okay, by this process.
Let's see. And it rained in on
the planet. Yeah, and obviously.
Everything they described already.
And the noise that don't get ripped up just fall right into the planet, right? So I think did we get everything there? I think we did. Let's see. 11,000... Yeah, okay, so let's read another paragraph here.
If space bodies are similar in size and density, collisions may occur. But if two space bodies of similar density are relatively unequal in size, then if the smaller progressively approaches the larger, the disruption of the smaller body will occur when the radius of its orbit becomes less than 2.5 times the radius of the larger body. Collisions among the giants of space are rare indeed, but these gravity tidal explosions of lesser bodies are quite common.
Okay.
You're still not talking about big meteors.
All right. So, okay. So this distance is called the Roche limit. I'll give you that much detail here about this, named after a French astronomer, that name. It's called the Roche limit, and they're giving you this 2.5 times, and that's from the center of the object. So 2.5, radii out from the center is the Roche limit, roughly. Again, you know, that's just a rough thumb, sort of back of the envelope, or, you know, rule of thumb. Because it depends upon the internal integrity of the object and everything, like I was just talking about. Okay, so it's a complicated thing. And you notice how they're throwing in the equal densities, roughly equal densities, and this sort of stuff. Okay, if you actually look at the calculations, you see what they're referring to there. But they're just, you know, giving you this rough thing. And so just kind of keep that as a rough, you know, thing. If you look at all the moons around the planets in the solar system, you know, you can just do a quick check. Look up the radius of the planet and take it times 2.5 and see how close some of those moons are to that. Okay? How close are they to the Roche limit? And all those ring systems are inside the Roche limit. Right? That's stuff that got too close and got ripped apart.
Which you'd expect.
Now, you know, and it's either going to be, you know, literally dust particles, like we think of dust, you know, being ground up rock, right? But remember, a lot of the moons are mostly water ice, you know, when you get out there, you know, so it can be just broken up into, you know, ice crystals, you know, too, for that ring system, if it's mostly ice that you're ripping apart and dissembling. Okay. But whatever the moon is made out of, you know, it just gets pulverized into a fine, you know, a ring of material around the planet. You know, and of course, that's a complicated thing. There's all sorts of friction and whatnot, and some of that will slowly drift into the planet and what have you, right, over time. But it's, you know, if you see a ring system, it's some moon has bit the dust.
So the beautiful rings.
Most likely.
The beautiful rings of Saturn are temporary.
You're right, they're not eternal.
Passing phenomena.
Yeah, and then like we've been saying, at some point, apparently even Saturn itself is not eternal. I mean, what's the point of Saturn, you know, when the grand universe is settled in light and life? You know, what's the point of Jupiter? What's the point of all the uninhabited solar system? You know, all this sort of stuff.
Get attached.
We have no idea what becomes of all this material. Okay, so that's what they're referring to. This, in astronomical circles, the famous Roche limit is what they're referring to here. Notice how they're, you know, pointing out that if you do have a couple of roughly equal mass objects that are very, you know, they're roughly the same size, yeah, you may actually get them, you know, coming together. At some point, like we talked about last time, in the early formation of the solar system, one of those objects that was captured from the Angana system, slammed into an early Venus, you know, and merged with it. Right? It didn't just get broken up into a ring around that thing. You know, they were roughly similar, and they just slammed right into it and merged together into one object. Yeah.
Now, what is it about that disclosure that is something we couldn't figure out? Because the Roche limit's obviously something we figured out.
Yep. Like I was hinting a little bit earlier, the main thing that you get this when you get to the very end of the section. You see kind of why they've thrown some of this stuff in. They're giving you little bits like this just so, because they know that initially the people are going to be reading this book are going to be people coming from a religious background. You know, the scientists, they know, are not going to be the first ones that are going to pick up this book.
Yeah,
it's people, you know, who'd see that this book has the word God in it, and go, "Ooh, I love books about God," yeah. And they start reading the book, right? And the main thing that those people need is they need to face facts and adjust them to their ideals in order to achieve wisdom. They have some initial relationship to ideals. But often such people are quite factually deficit and ignorant, have all sorts of magical notions about things, and probably have a very magic man, you know, monotheistic background, you know, because it's not like religions, religions that don't have a God, you know, you aren't going, oh, here's a book that has the word God in it, right? I mean, you know. You weren't interested in God in the first place in your so-called religion, you know, it wouldn't be immediately attractive to you. But, yeah, so you've got, you know, basically some sort of a fiat God, you know, idea in your head, and you were probably okay with the earth being made by the magic man in 4004 BC, you know? And you certainly wouldn't think of God creating in such messy ways, right? Or him doing it where if someone didn't intervene at some point, it would all go very unfortunate, right? For an inhabited planet. You know, it's like, okay, he just makes it and it's eternal, you know? No, it's the Father's just the initiator. You know, and all this evolutionary process either has to have a self-contained nature that's appropriate, or there's going to need to be other beings that step in at various points and do various things and whatnot. It's a very, very complicated thing. And so they're trying to just give you a little bit like that so that you think you think more factually about the universe that you live in. You can, you know, they give you little hints, like, you know, like I said, Roche limit. Okay, that's what scientists talk about. They encourage you to not, you know, get into some sort of complicated calculus, you know, analysis or something of it, but to have some basic sort of scientific relationship to this. If you can have a little bit of science to combine with your little bit of religion, you can get a super additive consequence of what the whole book is about. A philosophic awakening in your mind, right? And that philosophic mind won't have so many soap operas in its life, right? Yeah, spending the time to think about Roche limits a little bit will improve your relationships down the road, right? Because you are supplying favorable conditions to be grown. You know, by saying, I'm gonna, you know, I really love this book. I'm gonna make the effort to try to figure out what they're talking about here. That will pay great dividends down the road if you do. And it's not a huge demand. You know, especially with the internet now, you can just do some quick searches. You can read a few paragraphs. You can get the basic ideas here. You know, you don't have to take a whole course, you know, at the university level anymore like you had to in the ages past. And so you can educate yourself a little bit. Try to get a little bit more grounded in facts. Get a little bit more of a scientific mind. All right. Let's see. Okay, so I think we got everything there. Let's read a little bit more here.
Shooting stars occur in swarms because they are the fragments of larger bodies of matter which have been disrupted by tidal gravity exerted by nearby and still larger space bodies. Saturn's rings are the fragments of a disrupted satellite. One of the moons of Jupiter is now approaching dangerously near the critical zone of tidal disruption, and within a few million years will either be claimed by the planet or will undergo gravity tidal disruption. The fifth planet of the solar system of long ago, traversed an irregular orbit, periodically making closer and closer approach to Jupiter, until it entered the critical zone of gravity tidal disruption, was swiftly fragmentized, and became the present-day cluster of asteroids.
Okay. Now, you know, little meteors raining in on the Earth, you know, come in clusters. I mean, there's other reasons. I mean, you know, maybe a comet has kind of fallen apart. The sun is, is impacting comets. And, you know, but, you know, this is one of the ways that an object can get ripped apart and end up being a collection of objects that would then rain in. And remember how this early solar system is very chaotic, and especially you've got gravity. The gravity of Jupiter is a big issue. You know, it's if you took it out, okay, the sun, you know, would have a tendency to kind of get everyone in their place. You know, but Jupiter has its own ideas, right? I mean, it almost was another sun. You know, and suns like to have things orbiting about them, right? See, so you can imagine there's this tug of war. Is this stuff going to orbit about Jupiter, or is it going to orbit about the sun? And that planet was having a hard time finding a stable place to be, and so but eventually it got too close to Jupiter, and Jupiter ripped it apart. Okay, and right, if I can't have you, I'll destroy you. But you have Ceres, you know, which is a big enough residual of that planet that the internal gravity can form it into a sphere still. You know, the other stuff are all potato-shaped clods, right? But, you know, basically Ceres is, you know, what's left of the spherical nature of that fifth planet, okay, that largest asteroid. And obviously, if it's gotten to the point where it's developed, where it starts to separate the heavy stuff in the center from the lighter stuff on the outside, you rip it all apart, you're going to have some of those asteroids are going to be more core-like stuff, so they're going to be like iron meteorites, and some of the stuff farther out is going to be more like, you know, stony meteorites, and, you know, you're going to have that differential, because probably that planet had begun to get, you know, it wasn't all the same all the way through, and the heavier stuff was starting to get in the center, so you rip it all apart, and you'll have some of each flavor. You know, we have lots of meteorites raining in on the Earth, you know, and some of them are stony meteorites, some of them are iron meteorites. See, I mean, you obviously, that's from that different, you know, something that got those elements differentiated like that.
Yeah.
Right?
Part of a big body.
Yeah, it's part of a big body, you know, and before it got ripped apart.
Yeah. So, are gravity forces too weak to begin aggregating again? Are there other things keeping them mixed and separated?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you got them spread out over a big, big band there around the sun now, and so you know it would take a long time for things to, you know, to settle back in. Plus, Jupiter continues to be, you know, messing up the situation.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
It's got gravity.
Yeah, right. All right, so.
Second in command.
You know, it's sort of stirring. Jupiter is sort of stirring the pot all the time. You know. And then the other thing in there, when they say one of the moons of Jupiter is now approaching, that's Amalthea. It's a fairly small moon that's inside of the four Galilean moons. You know, the four big Galilean moons. You know, it's a sort of a potato-shaped object, but it's big enough where, you know, it's not just one of these rocks that's going to end up just falling into Jupiter, like a few other little things that are there with it. You know, like they're pointing out, it's big enough where it's going to get ripped apart probably. And if you look it up, you'll calculate what ratio of Jupiter's radius it is away from the center of Jupiter, it's just outside 2.5.
What's the name of it again?
Amalthea. Yeah. You know, it's big enough that we discovered it, you know, on Earth telescopes, you know, a long, long time ago. Right? You know, Jupiter has a, you know, when we sent the Voyagers through there, we discovered Jupiter has a thin little ring that we couldn't see from the Earth. Stuff gets ripped up and distributed into a ring system. You know, we now know that Uranus and Neptune have ring systems like that too. And we got out there, and you know, we could see them. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just Saturn. This is such a huge one, so you can see it from the Earth, you know, very easily. Okay, so that's what they're pointing out. And again, you know, remember that 2.5 is a rough ballpark number. But it is, you know, it's one of the reasons why they mentioned that one, because it works with their throwing out that sort of rough ballpark 2.5, that it's just outside of 2.5, you know, like they're saying, it's just outside of getting too close to being disrupted. You know, exactly at what distance, you know, it'll be disrupted, I don't know. But anyway, all right, so that's, so they just give you that little side. No, see, they wanted to take the opportunity to try to get you to think about a little bit of science. Just, you know, try to, you know, it's like, well, why is that? You know, and just try to get you to think scientifically a little bit. It's part of, like I said, the bigger desire that you get a philosophic consciousness going, you know, relative to the whole revelation. Okay, and they do occasionally are throwing in things. I mean, you know, they're telling you about 11,000 You know, we can speculate a lot about what exactly the, you know, the Roche limit for the moon might be, the relative to the Earth, and, you know, we can guesstimate and make various assumptions about that. You know that they can calculate it quite precisely, right? You know, and so, you know, they're throwing in little things like that.
You know, on the other hand, the creators took the solar system, which was still in a state of flux, not settled by any means, not completely chaotic like it was initially. I thought, well, we can start life here.
Yeah.
You know, it's stable enough for life.
Yeah, and we're coming up on those very thoughts. You'll see. You know, again, like I was just saying, you know they can calculate to many decimal places exactly what the Roche limit for the moon and the Earth would be. They can calculate exactly what's going to happen to this incredibly chaotic, sort of uncalculable mess from our perspective. You know, they can look at it at a very early stage, run forward, you know, several billion years and go, oh, no, there's going to be a planet that's just going to be spot on perfect. They can calculate all these seemingly incalculable, you know, complex systems very precisely. Right. And so they would be prepping this for a solar system that's going to have life, you know, way before, you know, the final steps. Okay, yeah, we actually have a planet now that everything is all cleaned up, that'll work. You know, they knew that way in advance, that there would be such a planet.
Well,
okay. Yep.
What about the one that's in the Kuiper Belt?
And then
there's another planet.
Right, there's another planet. They knew there would be two, you know. yep. All right. Okay, so finally now, you can see we're ready to actually take a step. You know, think about it. It's been clear back several pages back that we had a number, you know, an age of 4.5 billion. And we've been kind of doing all these little vignettes. And we're finally going to start stepping through a sequence of ages here again. Okay, so what do they give us next?
4 billion years ago witnessed the organization of the Jupiter and Saturn systems. Much is observed today except for their moons, which continued to increase in size for several billions of years. In fact, all of the planets and satellites of the solar system are still growing as the result of continued meteoric captures.
Okay, now the key thing here, when scientists try to calculate the time scales for the formation of the solar system the way they think it formed, you know, it was just a bunch of gas and dust that collapsed and condensed into the sun and the planets. I mentioned before, the time scales they have for that are really short. Okay. You know, Jupiter and Saturn didn't take like 10,000 years to form. Okay? Okay, but relative to other, you know, they do form quickly relative to, say, the Earth getting fully formed. Because remember, we were mentioning that before. You know, you basically just have to get a bunch of gas. Remember how there was two things, you know, they mentioned? There's gas contraction, remember, and then there's accretion. Right? You basically just have to have a bunch of gas contract into a, you know, tight sphere. So it's kind of just a gravity falling thing, right? It doesn't take forever. If I, you know, lift up this cup and drop it, it hits the floor pretty quickly, okay? I mean, if all you have to do is just have stuff fall into a sphere, you know, relatively speaking, it's a fairly quick process. So, you know, 500 million years after this all got initiated, you basically have Jupiter and Saturn, you know, majestically in place. Okay, roughly what they are right now. Not their moons, like they're saying, because that's not just a ball of gas that has to contract.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, there's
a bulge of gas that came off
That big central bulge of the long tongue, you know, just had to, you know,
they contract quickly.
Just had to contract into two spheres, yeah. Right. See, so it's a pretty straightforward process. I mean, in the current scientific thinking, you know, they certainly think of Jupiter and Saturn forming a lot faster than the other rocky planets. It's just that they have all of their time scales are way, way too short. Okay. You know, they're saying that, you know, think of 500 million years, okay, and you've got Jupiter and Saturn basically there. Don't think, you know, tens of thousands of years for Pete's sake. Yeah, like they're saying, you know, it's more complicated than that. And you can think about that. I mean, just think about what a messy process it was that gave rise to this. I mean, it's going to take a while for even that to settle down, you know, when it just has to contract like that. But relatively speaking, you know, they're first to the finish line, okay? And so they're basically there. And so once you have that, those two big objects stabilized, everything else can try to find its place between the three big objects, the Sun and Jupiter and Saturn, try to find a place where it's stable amidst that tug of war. All right, so what do they give us next? We're jumping right along here.
3 billion 500 million years ago, the condensation nucleuses of the other 10 planets were well formed and the cores of most of the moons were intact, though some of the smaller satellites later united to make the present-day larger moons. This age may be regarded as the era of planetary assembly.
Okay, so you give it a billion years from it getting initiated, and you not only have, with the other planets, the initial gas contraction, but it's actually condensed into a solid nucleus that things are going to start accreting onto. And you notice they mention in there, you got a couple of moons that are, you know, similar, and then they actually merge into a bigger moon. So that, like they were mentioning up above, that sort of stuff was involved in the formation of the objects in the solar system as well. Similar objects coming together as one object. But to bring in that addition of things cooling enough that it can condense and be a solid, you know, object that stuff is going to start to fall down on, rain down upon, that takes additional big chunk of time. You know, we jumped forward another 500 million years, right, to have well-formed, as they say, nucleuses. Right, so, long time scales. You know, in the current magical formation story, you know, they think, well, tops, you can go from nothing but a vast diffuse cloud of gas to a solid Earth the size it is right now in at most 100 million years. Right. Now, the time scales are much, much, much longer, right, than these magical scenarios that they paint in current thinking. You know, I mean, they'll even say, oh, and that's a way on the outside. Some models say, you know, just a few million years and you can get the whole Earth in place and have, you know, rocks that we can date on the surface. I mean, look at how off that is. And it's just like, you know, we think that stars have a time scale of billions of years. No, stars have a time scale of trillions of years. You can see we're often off by, you know, many orders of magnitude in our guesses of things. You know, the ages of things, the distances of things in the Milky Way galaxy, you know, we are way off on a lot of this stuff in our current attempts to estimate all this.
Yeah. Well, Saturn and Jupiter are called gas giants.
Yeah.
And the planets closer to the Sun anyway are called rocky planets.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah.
Okay. What happened to the... I mean, initially, there had to be... Everything must have been more the same.
Right. Again, it's all gas. The gas contracts, you know, and gets denser and denser. But, you know, if it's small and can cool off, it starts to condense. Okay,
like you're saying. Remember, you weren't here last week, but yeah, it comes out of the Sun on both different sides. And so it's not like it's coming out.
So what is rock today was at one time... gas.
I can heat up a rock and make it gas again if I want. Okay. I can melt it, okay, and then I can vaporize it. Right? But, right, I mean, it starts out, you just have, you know, you have this hot gas being pulled off the sun, and there's all sorts of different atoms in that gas. Hydrogen, helium, all the way up to uranium, you know, atoms, and whatnot. Right?
But isn't the gas of, most of the gas of Saturn and Jupiter mostly lighter elements?
Well, again, you know, we're just guesstimating what's in the center of those things.
Okay.
You know, all I can do is see the surface, you know, and then make guesstimates about what's inside. We do the same thing with the sun.
We have an idea of the density, don't
we? Right, right. So you can, right, you can make guesses, right? But obviously you're just, you know, you're just guessing. You're going on assumptions. I mean, you know, if you think that it was just a giant, you know, diffuse nebula of gas, I mean, you know, when we look out and we see those are, you know, mostly hydrogen, right? And so you think that basically it's going to be hydrogen. You know, so, you know, we run with those assumptions. But see, it's, that's not the way it works. You know, remember, you know, they think that the only way to make heavier elements is inside of stars, and then those stars have to blow up and spew those heavy elements all over the galaxy, you know, and then they can collect together and, you know, make uranium, you know, have uranium, you know, on this planet, say. You know, but actually, all those big elements, remember, they form in the cold depths of space. And so all those bigger elements are there in the initial condensation, you know, that is the sun. And, you know, and you're not just pulling the surface layers off the sun. You know, you're pulling this giant glob of material. You know, you basically, you know, kind of rip the sun in half practically. So you're getting all kinds of stuff from very deep, you know, pulled out, you know, into this tongue of matter. So there's all kinds of heavy elements. You know, even though the sun had been sitting there a long time, and obviously the heavier stuff would have tended to go towards the center. You know, and of course, as it gets to the center, it starts to get unraveled and, you know, stuff. You know, but anyway.
You've got that tidal movement. You've got that, even the heavy stuff gets squished out with the lighter stuff, you know, and that.
Yeah, it's just simply because it was such a, I mean, you know, right now you look at the surface of the sun, you know, you can see all kinds of iron lines, you know, in the spectrum. Yeah. And it's not like all the iron is sunk to, you know, I mean, remember, it's a vast boiling cauldron, you know. so, yeah, things are mixed up a lot, too. But
80 squared.
Okay. All right, so, but anyway, we got these very long time scales in actuality. That just to get to the point where you have, you know, kind of the initial little nucleuses, you know, that is going to build up into a planet, you know, it's taken a billion years to get to that point. You know, vastly longer than any scientist thinks that this process took. Okay, let's go one more notch.
3 billion years ago, the solar system was functioning much as it does today. Its members continued to grow in size as space meteors continued to pour in upon the planets and their satellites at a prodigious rate. About this time, your solar system was placed on the physical registry of Nebadon and given its name, Monmaisha.
Okay, so there it is finally. All right, so, you know, you don't quite know how early on this is until you read the next block, but this is very much an embryonic solar system. You know, when they say it was functioning much as it does today, that doesn't mean the planets are anywhere near as big as they are today. But you basically have cleaned things up after 1.5 billion years. Most of the, you know, of the debris is not just, you know, everywhere and everywhere, and it's a chaotic mess. Things are really starting to get settled down. You have the definitive planets in play. Obviously, the fifth one is going to get ripped apart eventually, but you know, as embryonic planets, except for Jupiter and Saturn, it's all recognizable, right? If you were shown this, a picture of this, you know, oh, there's Mercury, there's Venus, there's, you know, you could see the basic solar system in the midst of all the stuff, you know, that's still out and about, you know, but it's all basically there. Okay, so that you have 1.5 billion years of that, the formation of the embryonic solar system, and once that embryonic solar system, it's basically, you know, very obvious now where everything is going. You can calculate forward very definitively. It gets this name, okay? But remember what that name is: the mother place of man, not cool collection of dirt clods. Okay, man, right? It's already being projected as an inhabited solar system at this point, very definitively. You have literally, the master physical controllers, specifically, you know, the mechanical controllers, have come out, and they've begun to establish a cocoon of space, you know, around this solar system, to begin to separate it from, you know, the greater chaos, you know, in Norlaishadek, like they talk about. All right, to begin to establish a place that eventually will be habitable. It's not subject to all the, you know, disruptive energies in this region of the galaxy right now. Okay, so beings are getting involved now. Right, this is going to be an inhabited solar system. The power beings are starting to carve out a space, a protective space. And
so somewhere it does have a name. It's not this
name. It's not this name. It's not this English name, you know,
that
right?
Name that might mean something along.
Right. Right. See, so that's, you know, this is not the
Nebanon language.
Again, this is not a revelation of fact. This is a revelation of truth.
See the truth.
Yeah. Right. There is some name in the local universe tongue and the super universe tongue for this solar system to indicate that, you know, literally, you know, you've got this bubble region, you know, that's marked out by an active presence of beings, so they can name that region. It's not just, well, let's just draw an arbitrary circle here and call this state Colorado, you know, whatever. No, I mean, you have a presence of beings. You know, where do you know, how do you know when you're outside of Nebanon? When the presence of the creative mother spirit is no longer with you, right? Her presence defines its boundaries. The presence of those mechanical controllers defines the boundary.
Way out of the ordinary.
Yeah.
And then, okay, so now you've got this, and here it is.
Yeah. So 1.5 billion years to get to the point where beings start to come in. And you notice it's, you know, master physical controllers, the physical registry. Okay, it's not on any life registry yet, right? But it is definitely on a physical registry that the power beings have carved out a differential here relative to the background, and remember, those are those beings have a very significant anti-gravity presence, so they're already going to be altering where the orbits of the planets are and stuff. As soon as they, you know, are present there, you know, the planets will feel less gravity from the sun, right? Their orbits are going to shift, so they're settling in and becoming an active, you know, active participants in this further sorting out of where things are going to eventually be orbiting around the sun and whatnot. Yeah. Let's see. Anything else we need to say there? No, I think that's basically it. But just, you know, you now can start to see how there's some natural divisions in the history of the planet, and sort of this is like the first major division from 4.5 billion to 3 billion. You know, is sort of the first block. You know, of a certain flavor, and we're about to move into the next block of a certain flavor. Obviously, it's going to be all these meteors raining in and building up the rocky planets. Okay, that's the next phase here that we're moving into. All right, let's see what else they say here.
2,500,000,000 years ago, the planets had grown immensely in size. Urantia was a well-developed sphere about one-tenth its present mass and was still growing rapidly by meteoric accretion.
And just stop there. See, just to give you... So after 500 million years, they had grown immensely in size, and the Earth is just up to a tenth of its current mass. See, so again...
Mass meaning size this way,
or Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was pretty small.
Right, so the embryonic solar system at 3 billion years ago, see, like I said, they're just it's just embryonic, right? It's like single-celled planets, right? okay. Very embryonic, you know, they don't tell you exactly how big the Earth was back then, but it's obviously was pretty small if it's grown immensely and it's only a tenth of what it is right now. Okay, so very, very primitive stage at which they came in and said, yep, this one is going to work, and let's start setting up shop. All right, okay, get the rest of it there.
All of this tremendous activity is a normal part of the making of an evolutionary world on the order of Urantia and constitutes the astronomic preliminaries to the setting of the stage for the beginning of the physical evolution of such worlds of space in preparation for the life adventures of time.
See, like I said, how the section ends, you're wading through all this very scientific, factual sorts of stuff. And they remind you of why they're giving you that. You know, as much as you can, like we've stressed this many times, don't separate things and beings so much. You know, think of how transcendent of the appearance of the stark separation between things and beings. It's all one system, right? You know, and... You can't immediately observe that, but matter, mind, and spirit are together in a triunity, an evolutionary triunity, and it's all one system. And you are, when all is said and done, studying all of this stuff about the formation of the embryonic solar system is also studying the evolution of the will creatures of this planet. They're not really two separate things. There's an Earth that evolved and has nothing to do with the evolution of life. No, it's all just one evolution. Okay? And that this is all in ways that is not even understandable to the revelators. All this rigmarole is necessary in some way for life to be what it is. Because if part of it is, you know, like we often stress, right now a lot of my life doesn't have individual meaning, right? A lot of my life is drop of water in the ocean meaning, right? It's part of the supreme in terms of its immediate meaning. You know, it's not meaning, you know, relative to me in eternity. It's meaning relative to the supreme being in eternity. You know, the Supreme Being is a power personality synthesis. All this rigmarole, you know, exactly where every dust particle was at every point in this chaos of this solar system, all that has some meaning in the whole of the finite. Exactly which moons get ripped apart by tidal forces at what time, and all that stuff has some inscrutable meaning in the wholeness of the Supreme Being. And you know, and so just as seemingly meaningless, if you think about it, it's like, well, this all seems kind of meaningless. Yeah, does that remind you of a lot of your life that you're having a hard time seeming as meaningless? You got to remember that there's a really big picture here that's not you. And an awful lot that goes on no one will understand the meaning of it until we all get to the grand universe, settled in light and life, and look and look back. It's like, oh, that's why the fifth planet got ripped apart. You know, in supremacy, there are no coincidences. You know, that all somehow fits into some inscrutable big picture, that planet got ripped apart. When it did and how it did and all these things. So, I mean, it should, even though you can't directly understand this, you can know that everywhere you turn is just endless mystery. You know, let the universe around you come alive with the mystery that it is. You know, in supremacy, it's not a coincidence that table is in that location on the floor right now. There's some sort of, you know, it's like, well, no, it's because Chris put it in that spot. There's no meaning there. No, everything has meaning somehow. Let the universe be filled with that mystery. No magic, but lots of really cool mystery, right? There's nothing really mundane, right? Every snowflake falls on a certain path and some meaning in the whole. Right? The universe is really cool like that. Right? All right, so they're just trying to remind you, this is the way life evolves. It starts out with embryonic solar systems and all this stuff. That's part of the evolution of life. It's not just once you finally have eukaryotic cells. Right? This is part of the evolution of life too. Right. All right, and so as you can see from the title of the next section here, you know, we've moved into this meteoric age. Right, there's a block of time when basically it's you know, Jupiter and Saturn are there, but you've got these little nucleuses, and just meteors are just, you know, raining in incessantly, building up these objects, building up the other planets. All right, so let's read a little more here.
Section 7, the meteoric era, the volcanic age, the primitive planetary atmosphere. Throughout these early times, the space regions of the solar system were swarming with small disruptive and condensation bodies, and in the absences of a protective combustion atmosphere, such space bodies crashed directly on the surface of Urantia. These incessant impacts kept the surface of the planet more or less heated, and this, together with the increased action of gravity as the spheres grew larger, began to set in operation those influences which gradually caused the heavier elements, such as iron, to settle more and more toward the center of the planet.
Okay, see, so we're starting to get things, differentiated in density. The density is starting to have a profile of increasing towards the center, you know, and it can definitely settle out like that because the thing is kept molten by just, you know, all of this energy input of these meteors slamming in all the time. It's basically just keeping it, you know, in a pretty churned up and molten state. But it is definitely wanting to be condensed, you know. And you notice, too, in terms of all the chaotic stuff that's still out and about, you know, they describe them disruptive and condensation bodies. You know, you don't have gas raining in, basically. Right? You've got stuff that's condensed into rocks, and, you know, you have, you know, what we think of as meteorites, you know, literally, you know, raining in as rocks.
Well, no H2O yet, right?
Oh, yeah. You mean you're going to have lots of water, you know. Oh, yeah. I mean, you don't have oceans yet because everything's so hot, you know. But you're getting there. Remember, this. We've got all the elements here in play, you know. And when it starts to get to the point where things are condensing, you know, water is going to form out of hydrogen and oxygen. Right. So, you know, that's in the mix. Obviously, it gets hot, it boils off and whatnot, you know. But you'll see they're going to get to that in a minute. So start to think of, you know, something that's kind of has all of the basic materials that you know of, but it's still in a pretty unsettled state. you know, it's, you haven't gotten to the point yet where you can really think of sort of, okay, here's the surface and it's going to kind of stay like that. You know, it gets smashed up over and over again. You know, some great big huge object comes in and the whole thing just kind of gets jumbled up and condenses together again at this point. But eventually we're going to get to, you know, where it's going to be pretty much have a surface, an ongoing surface, and stuff is going to be raining in on the surface to a degree, rather than flopping into a puddle of magma, right?
I still have my earlier question.
Yep.
I'm not satisfied.
Yeah, okay, yep.
That's, it seems like there's missing gas. Has the gas somehow been pulled out of it by some, either by the sun or these gas giants?
Well, I mean, obviously a lot of the gas of that tongue condensed into Jupiter and Saturn. You know, and you got Uranus and Neptune also. But again, the gas is cooled and condensed. You know, liquid and solid. When you cool a gas, it becomes, you know, gases are temperature dependent.
Right? Okay.
You know, no gas will stay a gas if things get too cool. Right? Right. So that's just, you know, initially everything's very hot. You know, but as things cool and cool, eventually it starts to, like, they keep stressing condensation bodies. That, you know, that's not contraction bodies. That's, you know, things have condensed.
Okay.
You know, gas to liquid to solid.
The heat's just radiating out into the...
Right, heat is radiating out into space and, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so let's see. Anything else there? We go off on these tangents, and then I forget if there's something else I wanted to say. Let's see. Just, you know, I mean, just to stress, disruptive. You know, so we're still in a stage where, you know, things are can be quite dramatically disrupted, like I was trying to stress there. Nothing is very settled yet. You know, incessant impacts. And let's see. Okay, yeah, so let's take the next step forward here.
2 billion years ago, the Earth began decidedly to gain on the Moon. Always had the planet been larger than its satellite, but there was not so much difference in size until about this time, when enormous space bodies were captured by the Earth. Urantia was then about one-fifth its present size, and had become large enough to hold the primitive atmosphere, which had begun to appear as a result of the internal elemental contest between the heated interior and the cooling crust.
Okay, so we're getting to the point where, especially in the wake of these apparently very large objects slamming in and obviously messing things up quite a bit, but it's starting to settle in where. You have a quasi-crust, at least, you know, for spans of time. And so you can think about having, you know, an atmosphere above that crust, you know, and an interior, you know, so you can start to kind of think in normal terms about a planet. You know, you know, you've got, you know, you always have, gases where, or your elements where they'll be in gaseous state, because it's, things are not going to get that cold, right? The oxygen and nitrogen in our atmosphere, you know, the Earth never gets so cold and it's never going to get so cold, you know, that those will condense, you know, and snow out onto, onto the surface of the planet, right? Right, so, you know, you've got some things that are, you know, are staying in gaseous form, but you can imagine initially, I mean, you can't talk about an atmosphere. It's all just, you know, you can imagine this great big object plows in. It's like, well, there's no surface now for a while because it just, you just blew it all up and it's got it all collected together. But, you know, you're starting to get to the point where it's a, you know, it's up to one-fifth it's present, right? So, you know, just think about it slowly moving towards what, you know, what's understandable, where you're going to have solid stuff collected together and gas on the outside of that. Now, obviously, gas gets trapped inside the object. We all know that, you know, there's gases that get, are trapped inside the earth and stuff. But it's starting, you know, you saw in the previous thing, they said it's starting to differentiate. The heavier ones are starting to be towards the center and the lighter ones at the surface. So you start to get that lighter crust. And okay.
Talk about the moon and the earth being the same size. And, you know, you don't always think of that. And a lot of people think that, you know, the moon came from the earth, but it really didn't, obviously.
Right.
But at one point, they were pretty much the same size. So because my first question was, well, why did the moon not capture all this stuff instead of the earth capturing it, as you were saying, as far as coming in?
Right. Well, you know,
not that far apart.
Now, they pointed out that the earth was a little bit bigger, so maybe that had some, you know, the why it got the big, you know, but it might have just been fortuitous that that one collected the, you know, more stuff. You know, eventually when it gets big enough difference, then the, you know, the earth is always going to collect more than the moon, and you know,
it's an affront to my spiritual consciousness. It's not fair.
Well, but it's funny that two basically, you know, orbs that size were pretty that close together, and you know, and then at that time, they neither one had atmosphere. I never really thought about it that way.
I mean, again, you know, where did these objects come from? You know, they're coming at some angle, and coincidentally, they happen to slam into the Earth rather than the Moon. You know, there's got to be some, you know, some just you know, randomness, as we would say, you know, to this. But
Some are slamming into the Moon too.
Yeah, lots are slamming into the Moon. The Moon's got to do a lot of growing yet too. Again, we're, you know, if the Earth is only a fifth its present size, the Moon is a long way from its present size as well, right? At this early stage. Okay, but as they're saying there, you know, it is starting to settle down enough that you can begin to really talk about a crust. And once you have a crust, okay, you've got really hot stuff, you know, bubbling away on the inside that's going to want to poke through that crust. You know, you can start to have volcanic activity. Obviously, the word volcano doesn't mean anything if you don't really have a crust yet. Right? But once you start to get sort of a crust, it's not just going to be a meteoric accretion phenomenon. You're going to also start to have volcanic activity through that crust, right, from the molten interior. All right, so you're going to get this additional phenomenon added to the physical dynamics of the planet at this point.
It's going to grow from the inside out as well.
Right, I mean, stuff that, you know, that was on the inside is going to, you know, be brought up, you know. Right, you know, so you're going to start to get, you know, that phenomenon going.
Okay? So the lighter elements are being disgorged.
Right, and obviously a great big, you know, meteor can come slamming in and, you know, and totally melt a big chunk of the crust and, you know, and you know, it's still, you know, but it's, you know, because it's only a fifth, so you got a lot of stuff to add yet, right? Okay. But you're starting to get some temporary crust at least, you know, and so another dynamic can start, volcanic activity. You know, and initially it's not going to be this pretty little volcano. I mean, it's just going to be, you know, a whole region, you know, is going to bubble up a whole bunch of stuff, right?
That's a stupid question.
Yeah.
why is it stay spherical then? If stuff's coming in, you know, maybe more stuff's coming in one second, why isn't it growing into a pear shape like that?
Well, again, I mean, and if something slams in initially, you know, it won't be a sphere, but gravity is going to rearrange it into a sphere pretty quickly. Okay. Yeah.
Gravity.
Yeah, gravity is always trying to keep it in a sphere. Because, right, I mean, there's the spherically symmetric centering influence of the Isle of Paradise. That wants to make everything, you know, spherical. Yeah. let's see. Did we get everything there? I think we did. Yeah. So let's. Okay. Now they're going to throw in another little tidbit of scientific info.
Definite volcanic action dates from these times. The internal heat of the Earth continued to be augmented by the deeper and deeper burial of the radioactive or heavier elements brought in from space by the meteors. The study of these radioactive elements will reveal that Urantia is more than 1 billion years old on its surface. The radium clock is your most reliable timepiece for making scientific estimates of the age of the planet, but all such estimates are too short because the radioactive materials open to your scrutiny are all derived from the Earth's surface and hence represent Urantia's comparatively recent acquirement of these elements.
Okay, several things there. Let's just step through them. So the first part of the paragraph is this, you know, the main story we're telling. So you're starting to get some definite volcanic action, like we were saying. And remember why the Earth still stays so hot inside right now, why we still have volcanic action. So you've got all of those radioactive elements down inside producing heat. You know, they give off a lot of energy. Those are exothermic reactions. So you've got heat being pumped into the interior of the Earth constantly by all that radioactive decay, keeping things molten inside. Yeah, and keeping volcanoes going and plates moving and plate tectonics and all that stuff, right? So they're bringing in that issue.
And that was from the original planet that was one tenth the size, or is that something coming raining in?
Again, it's just, you know, all those radioactive elements are all over.
Okay. You know, they're just captured.
And they're just being captured by the Earth, and obviously. You know, a lot of it, you know, when the Earth is still, you know, very molten, a lot of that is going to sink to the center, like they said up above there. All the heavy elements are going to start to sink. So there's a lot of radioactive elements down in the Earth right now. Okay, so they've got that, and then they throw these zingers in, these non sequiturs, apparent non sequiturs. The study of these radioactive elements will reveal that Urantia is more than 1 billion years old on its surface. You're going, no, we study those radioactive elements, we use radiometric dating, and we find that it's more than 4 billion years old on the surface.
So this person who wrote this book doesn't know what they're talking
about. So obviously whoever wrote this book doesn't know what they're talking about.
That's
Also, right. Remember, if we could figure that out ourselves, they couldn't say that. Right? Right. The problem is we think it's four. No, I mean, you know, eventually we're going to get to 1 billion years ago here at the beginning of the next section, right, when you actually have the surface that basically we have right now. And then they say the radium clock is your most reliable timepiece for making scientific estimates of the age of the planet. And you're going, doesn't seem like it. Seems like it's off by a factor of four. Okay? But if you have it properly calibrated, which they just gave you the calibration number, and they're going to give you a lot more as we go forward, right? You can use that method. If you calibrate it properly, it's a great method. But it's got to be properly calibrated.
Then it says they're all too short, and you just finished saying they're too
long. Right, okay. I haven't gotten to that yet. I told you it's one step at a time. It's not all talking about the same thing here. One step at a time. Okay, so you got that part that you got that factor of four, like I told you, that we're now starting to, you're getting close to bringing into play. Because we have dates that are actually, you know, a little more than a billion years old, like, you know, they have here. You know, that we get a little bit more than four billion for a radiometric date. You know, so we're approaching something that we have radiometric dates for. You know, at 1.5 billion that we're getting to next, you know, we don't have anything, you know, that old that we date that's actually 1.5 billion.
Which would mean six.
Right, which would mean six, exactly. we have stuff that's, you know, four and a half, right? Okay, and then they try to remind you of another thing, and I mentioned this before. You know, so we get these, find these rocks on the surface of the Earth, and we date them a little over 4 billion years old, and we go, well, that's how old the solar system is. And they're trying to remind you, wait a minute, guys, that's illogical. You think about it. You're just dating the stuff on the surface. Now, how could that be the age of the solar system? And we say, well, yes, but it only took a couple million years for the Earth to form. So the difference between the surface rocks and the beginning of the solar system is a difference in, you know, when it's, you know, I mean, that's in the noise, you know, of the 4.5 million.
But what about the fact that if these came from out something, you know, in the solar system that crashed under the Earth, maybe they were created that long ago?
Right. Well, right. You see, so you've got those possibilities, right?
Okay. I'm just.
Right. But.
Anyway.
But remember, we've never come across some. You know, you might find some object that would have a radiometric date a lot older than 4.5 billion, and then we'd really begin to think about, oh, we've got something, you know, some improper assumption going on here, right? But right now, it all seems to be a tidy rationalization scheme on humans' part, right? That we humans basically ignore this simple fact that they're saying there. It's like, think about it, guys. You're just taking stuff from the surface. It's a big planet. You know, it took a long time to get to that point. And we go, no, it didn't. It took almost no time, relative to billions of years. So you can see how this is a logical package. The story that the Revelator is getting you all fits together. You know, it is important to know the difference between the center of the Earth and the surface of the Earth, because it took a long time.
Yeah.
It took 3.5 billion years to get to the current surface of the Earth. It didn't take a few million years. Yeah. Right? So the difference is significant. But in the current story, it didn't take much time at all. See, so we have, you can create these tidy, self-consistent rationalization schemes that are totally false.
But I'm confused.
Yep.
So, if it's saying that that it's 1/4 the time we think it is, correct?
Right, back at this date.
Right.
It's a factor of 4.
And the reason that we think it's that is because we're measuring stuff that's on the surface.
No. Oh. No, you're blurring two things together.
No, the reason that we're not measuring.
No, what's the reason for the factor of 4? We talked about that before. It has nothing to do with the surface or anything like that. Right? It has to do with way back here, 1.5, or 1 billion years ago, the subelectronic activity is much, much higher. The master physical controllers haven't brought it down to the current levels. Things are decaying much more rapidly back then.
Okay, I didn't get that part.
Right, that's the reason for the factor of 4. You know, we look at a certain amount of decay of uranium through the radium thing that they're talking about here. At today's rate, it would have to be 4 billion years old.
Oh, I see. It decayed a lot faster.
But it decayed a lot faster back then.
Oh, okay. I got you.
It's actually only 1 billion years old.
I see. Okay.
Okay. That's the reason for the difference.
See, a scientist would say you're playing with the facts. You can't play with the facts.
So why is the difference between when they say, but you're only measuring stuff that's on the surface?
Right. So the reason it's important the Revelators bring that out, it's like, if you don't have the Earth magically forming in a few million years, like the current story, then obviously there's a big, big difference between, dating a rock when it crystallized that's on the surface, and some rock that may be way deeper in crystallized a long time ago. Now, of course, the problem is, you go deep in and it's all molten. There is, nothing is crystallized. It's molten, okay? But they're just trying to remind you that in this story, it doesn't happen magically fast. This is a big deal, right? If you could have gone back to when the Earth was like a tenth its size, and there was something that was crystallized on the surface and snatched that rock off the surface, that's long, you know, since been melted, you know, and it's not a, a rock anymore. But if you grabbed that off the surface back then, you know, and you dated that, you'd get this really, really old date, right? Yeah. You know, like if it was from 3 billion years ago. Right, you'd get 12.
Because it's the same thing. Right. Aging fast, yeah. The clock's not done
right. Right, see, again, it's a clock, but you got to know that the clock ran faster in the past than it runs now. You got to have that calibration point.
I think the way they say open to your scrutiny kind of implies that they're there, we just can't get to them.
Yeah, I mean, see, again, they're saying, you know, if you knew her today, you could find some, you know, that crystallized a lot longer ago, and you'd get some very eye-popping radiometric dates.
And so also, estimates are too short, because the radioactive materials open to your scrutiny are all derived from the Earth's surface, and therefore, hence, represent Uranus's comparatively recent acquirements of these elements. Were those the ones that are coming out of space, right? Hitting, and they're not coming from up in the inside, they're coming from the outside.
Again, and what they mean is, you remember, you're dating when a rock crystallized, not when that element formed. That element has been around for ages, right? Okay. You're not dating elements, you're dating when a rock crystallized, you know, so that all the atoms are trapped in it. Nothing can get in, nothing can get out. You've got this fixed ratio that's, you know, changing.
Rock.
Right, it's locked in a rock, right? You know, again, they're just, you know, those rocks on the surface crystallized much more recently than anything down deeper, you know, if you just think in terms of it building up. You know, they're just that basic, they're just reminding you of that basic thing. But obviously, the crust is pretty thin. You can't go very deep.
What does recent acquirements mean?
I mean, again, when you know, once you have it really a solid surface, you know, you're piling stuff on
from outer space,
right? From all the meteors raining on.
That's what I thought.
The whole thing is growing by meteoric accretion. Yeah,
right.
But they're crystallizing after they're on it.
But and again, of course, you know, stuff gets remelted and you know and recrystallized, you know, and
the clock is reset every time.
Every time something melts, the clock gets reset.
Oh.
See?
See, I'm one of those religionists.
Right. But see, yeah, you got to think it through about exactly, you know.
Somebody's got to explain it to me because.
But there could be solid ones that we just haven't.
Right.
If we get a space rock, we're lucky. And it stays solid.
Yeah.
The
current meteors we've dated, you know, are all in the same ballpark. We haven't found any yet that are more than just a little more than, you know, 4 billion years old for a radiometric date.
But there'll be a spoiler at some point.
It
looks like it's 30 billion years old. Okay. This changes everything.
Okay. All right, let's see. All right, so they just throw in that little aside again, get you to think a little bit about the scientific issues. And like I said, the main thing is they're throwing some non sequiturs in there to make sure that you really think this through about how the Urantia has this self-consistent story. Current scientists have this self-consistent story. So they're both rational. But one is logical and the other one isn't. All right? You know, you've got to, you know, when someone says to you, the Earth went from nothing but gas in a big cloud to what it is right now, you know, with surfaces and oceans and everything, you know, in a few million years, you have to just shake your head, no, it didn't.
It's
like, well, you're not a scientist. You can't just say, yeah, I don't have to be a scientist. I know that's illogical. That doesn't make sense. It's got to take longer than that. Yeah.
Much less a day.
Yeah. I mean, there's no difference between a few million years and 7 days. I mean, again, the two stories that are supposed to be so radically different aren't.
Yeah.
Right? 3.8 billion, you know, and a few thousand years. Okay, the difference is of no consequence. Right? That's the thing. I mean, it's amazing how, you know, you have these scientists that think they've made this great break from the mythologies, the religious mythologies of the past, but they really haven't.
Still magical.
Yeah, it's still magical stories. You know, it's magical for the Earth to form in a few million years.
Magic number A or magic number B.
No wonder Jesus was never in a hurry. He'd been around too long.
Look at his time scale.
And the fact that you've come up with a whole bunch of rationalization schemes that seem to all validate your assumption it takes a few million years, you need to rethink it, they're trying to tell you. Right? This is how long it took. Don't be satisfied with the process until it matches this time scale.
It's your calibration standard.
Right. They're giving you the calibration that you can't get yourself. And everything else needs to fit into this framework. That's what they're trying to give us. Okay.
1,500,000,000 years ago, the Earth was two-thirds its present size, while the Moon was nearing its present mass. Earth's rapid gain over the Moon in size enabled it to begin the slow robbery of the little atmosphere which its satellite originally had.
Why don't you read the next one, too?
Volcanic action is now at its height. The whole Earth is a veritable fiery inferno, the surface resembling its earlier molten state before the heavier metals gravitated toward the center. This is the volcanic age. Nevertheless, a crust consisting chiefly of the comparatively lighter granite is gradually forming. The stage is being set for a planet which can someday support life.
Just let me remind you, that's where it's all heading. And this is all the evolution of life. Okay, so from 3 billion to 1.5 billion, you know, it is basically that meteoric age. And now we've moved into a final phase before a billion years ago of 500 million years, that's this volcanic age. In terms of ages of where you're forming, you know, really forming the Earth. You've got these three different stages of forming the Earth. Getting the embryonic Earth, doing the meteoric accretion, which is the primary thing, and then reworking it with volcanism for a final piece. Right. Okay?
But you can assess the clocks.
Yeah.
And adjust your clock.
Every time something melted, it resets the clock. No matter if it happened to be stuff that was some of the very first stuff that collected, you know. It's gotten all churned up and melted and spewed out on the surface again, you know, its clock gets reset. So you can see how this is, you know, starting a new phase. I mean, you basically have the Moon there. And see, so they're pointing out, this is kind of a good demarcation line at 1.5 billion years ago.
Why italicize that sentence?
Italicize, this is the volcanic age? Just so you can, like I said, you got a ready name for this block of time from 1.5 to 1 billion years ago. Okay. It's the volcanic age. And, you know, someone was asking, oh, yeah, you mentioned about atmospheres of the Moon and stuff. I mean, initially, obviously, there's going to be some atmosphere, but, you know, the Earth is going to suck it all off.
You didn't have to say robbery. You feel sorry for the Moon. See what the religionist does with that? They're already evil.
But, you know, you're going, well, aren't they anthropomorphizing it? What have I been stressing? There's some truth to anthropomorphizing the language. This is the evolution of us, right? It's not just the evolution of the dirt balls, okay?
Follow that a little bit.
I was talking about that while you were out of the room here a little bit ago. I mean, just all of this stuff we're reading here.
You talked about it last week, too.
Is the evolution of us, the matter and the things and the beings are all one system. You can't evolve will creatures without all of this evolution. All of this is part of the evolution of will creatures. That's the main point.
Okay.
And so when they occasionally, I point this out often, they'll throw in, kind of anthropomorphic language like that, it's not because they were getting bored and, you know, wanted to spice it up a little bit, okay? That it's a subtle reminder to think about it as a whole system of things and beings, not just things on one side and beings on the other side. And it's all one system. It's all living in the wholeness of the Supreme, okay? All this physical evolution you can literally think of as being very directly related to the eventual body of the Supreme Being.
A holistic orientation that they
want to give. Right, right. They're just trying to encourage that, you know, not just be, you know, delightfully poetic in their use of language. Okay. But you can see, like I was saying, I mean, obviously early on, it's going to be a veritable fiery inferno. I mean, the volcanic activity is going to be very widespread, you know. Huge regions, you know, will just, you know, go bubbling up and molten, you know, and have to recrystallize a crust and stuff, okay?
It's going to be glowing and putting off light, right? You can see it from space.
Yeah, it's going to be giving off lots of heat and light, and yeah. All right. But, you know, you can see we're starting to talk about granite, and of course you could, you know, basalt has got to be in play somewhere too, and that'll come up next time, and we'll bring in basalt. But you know, you're starting to get granite here, and just they're about to mention it. Let me just remind you, you know, you start talking about rocks like granite, you know, any oxygen that you have is one of the places it's going is into making all these rocks. You know, you got to have quartz, silicon dioxide, right? That takes oxygen. You know, you've got aluminum oxides and potassium and sodium oxides and calcium oxides and iron oxides. And I mean, it takes a lot of oxygen to make rocks. Okay, so you know, there's not going to be a lot of oxygen left to be in the atmosphere. You're starting to get it locked into a whole bunch of rocks. Okay, so you see what they say here next.
But initially, there was a lot of oxygen.
Yeah, I mean, again, initially, like when you pulled off the big tongue, you know, there's all kinds of oxygen gas there, right? But it's getting locked up in various things.
Mentioned combustion atmosphere, that's oxygen.
Right, and they'll mention combustion some more. I mean, you've got oxygen getting used in combustion.
Contains an oxide is a consequence of combustion?
Well, just, I mean, you know, you've got metals, you know, that are combining with oxygen, and yeah. Okay.
The primitive planetary atmosphere is slowly evolving, now containing some water vapor, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, and hydrogen chloride. But there is little or no free nitrogen or free oxygen. The atmosphere of a world in the volcanic age presents a queer spectacle. In addition to the gases enumerated, it is heavily charged with numerous volcanic gases, and as the air belt matures, with the combustion products of the heavy meteoric showers, which are constantly hurtling in upon the planetary surface. Such meteoric combustion keeps the atmospheric oxygen very nearly exhausted, and the rate of meteoric bombardment is still tremendous.
Yeah, so you can see you've got, you know, water vapor and carbon dioxide, for instance, you know, obvious combustion products. And you've got some hydrochloric acid, right, in play. But, you know, the nitrogen and the oxygen are getting incorporated into stuff. Right? There's not a lot of anything left to be in the atmosphere. Okay. All right, let's keep going.
Presently, the atmosphere became more settled and cooled sufficiently to start precipitation of rain on the hot, rocky surface of the planet. For thousands of years, Urantia was enveloped in one vast and continuous blanket of steam. And during these ages, the sun never shone upon the Earth's surface.
See, so somewhere between 1.5 billion years ago and 1 billion years ago, you're going to start to have surface water. And so, you know, you're going to, when we find really old stuff from, you know, a little bit more than 1 billion years ago in actual age, you know, actual date, you know, we'll find stuff that we know there had to be surface water involved, you know, in the formation of that mineral, say. And see, they're pointing that out. Yeah, it's starting to rain down. You're going to have localized lakes and stuff at least.
That would be stuff we call 4 billion years.
What was that? Yeah, what we call a little more than 4 billion years old, yes. Like, so instead of 4.4 like we get, it's actually 1.1. Okay. So it's in this block that we're reading right now, this volcanic age. All right, keep going here.
Much of the carbon of the atmosphere was abstracted to form the carbonates of the various metals, which abounded in the superficial layers of the planet. Later on, much greater quantities of these carbon gases were consumed by the early and prolific plant life.
Okay, so just a little aside, you'll often hear me remind you of this. You can, when you look at Venus and Mars, you know they haven't been terraformed because they still just basically have that carbon dioxide atmosphere. Most of the atmosphere of Venus and Mars is carbon dioxide. Okay. Little bit of nitrogen. You know, it's basically a carbon dioxide atmosphere. And the Earth started out that way, too. See, back here, before it was terraformed, it's basically a carbon dioxide atmosphere. Meaning the story that we haven't gotten to yet. It's coming up in the next section, where the power beings come in and start terraforming the planet, producing the nitrogen and oxygen atmosphere and everything, getting it ready for life. But natural process produces basically a carbon dioxide atmosphere.
It has nothing to do with terrorism.
No, it has to do with terra, like terra firma. Not terror forming, terra forming. Okay. See, but you start out. I mean, you see some of the, you know, like they're. Like we were talking about the oxygen getting incorporated into rocks. I mean, some of the carbon gets incorporated into rocks too, you know, making carbonate, or nitrate, you know. You get some of the nitrogen with oxygen, you know, put into rocks. Initially a lot of stuff is just getting, you know, balled up into the sphere and is not left to be a free atmospheric gas.
One breath of this atmosphere in our lungs.
Yeah. Okay.
Even in the later periods, the continuing lava flows and the incoming meteors kept the oxygen of the air almost completely used up. Even the early deposits of the soon appearing primitive ocean contained no colored stones or shales. And for a long time after this ocean appeared, there was virtually no free oxygen in the atmosphere, and it did not appear in significant quantities until it was later generated by the seaweeds and other forms of vegetable life.
Yeah, again, you know, stressing this oxygen thing. Remember, you know, that... you've got nitrogen, oxygen atmospheres on the architectural worlds, right? And they didn't get those atmospheres naturally. Guess what? You don't get those atmospheres naturally on a naturally formed sphere either. A nitrogen, oxygen atmosphere is artificial.
So seaweed's not natural? Oh, that's because it has plant life.
Right? You know, last time I checked, granite doesn't turn into seaweed by itself.
acids, then, boom.
Right. Just remember that. See, that's a huge thing. I mean, the universe is mind-made and personality-managed. Right? I mean, there is nothing natural about an inhabitable world. It's very much an artificial domain. What about a non-breather world? They don't need an atmosphere and all this sort of stuff. Yeah, well, we've talked about that, you know. One day they go, I wonder who built these underground, facilities that we live in, right, to protect them from all the stuff raining in on the surface, right? I mean, there's nothing natural about a planet being inhabitable, even for non-breathers. It's artificial.
Before they got the intelligence
to do it themselves. Someone has protected them.
They couldn't come on the surface until they mastered that.
Right. Right. Yeah, and... the simple thing of every time you think about the nitrogen and oxygen in the room you're in, remember, that didn't get there naturally. It's an artificial fact that you're breathing in and out. Okay.
The primitive planetary atmosphere of the volcanic age affords little protection against the collisional impacts of the meteoric swarms. Millions upon millions of meteors are able to penetrate such an air belt to smash against the planetary crust as solid bodies. But as time passes, fewer and fewer prove large enough to resist the ever stronger friction shield of the oxygen enriching atmosphere of the later eras.
Just a little reminder again of that artificialness. It serves many purposes, not just for your breathing.
Protects us from those meteors.
Yeah, it'd be a little hard to live if your skull is being punctuated by meteorites all the time.
Even a hailstorm, I guess, skull. Pretty.
Right. Okay. So we finally are through all of the preliminaries. Next time we start with, we've got the Earth up to its current size. And we can start to tell a story that we have a very parallel story with radiometric dates that we tell. The basic story that you learn in historical geology class. I hope you can see, they were trying to give you the precursors to that, just a little thumbnail sketch of just how much mysterious stuff goes into getting it to the point where we have a little bit better sense of the story. All right, let's take a moment here.